Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Well, hello, Tom.
Good morning.
Yes, yes, yes. The printer's missing.
It's gone.
It's gone. But now you have the whole world in behind you there. I think that's really impressive.
It's true.
Is that recursive? You're on the world, but it's behind you, but you're on the world that's behind. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking when I put it in my office.
So today we have Bob Friday, who is big in the Onuk and works for Mist Systems, and he has a spiral staircase in the background, and I'm so jealous. That's what I'm jealous of today is the spiral staircase. So, Bob, how are you today? I think you're in Sunnyvale or San Jose or something, right?
Yeah, we are in California here, about 8 miles from the fires, watching the smoke and ash come down.
Oh my, that's not good. So, all right. So today we're talking about artificial intelligence and networks and potentially a bit about leaving data in place rather than warehousing. So let's begin with the AI piece. So, Bob, where did this start? I mean, I know there's been a lot of talk about AI. AI is the hype of the hypes today and everything like that. And I know there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt around it. So why don't we start with kind of where this concept started of using AI networks and like how it developed a little bit.
Yeah, for me personally, it started back in my Cisco days. So I was the mobility CTO at Cisco. And after the Meraki acquisition, you could see cloud was going to become an important piece of the puzzle. But also, I don't know if you guys remember Watson playing Jeopardy.
Right.
Yep. So that was one of the other inspirations for Mist was, hey guys, if they can build something that can play Jeopardy, we should be able to build something that can answer questions on par with network domain experts. And so that was kind of the original thesis or origin of, this AI stuff is becoming real. And I think if you go back and look at Google and stuff, you'll find something in 2014, all this AI stuff kind of started taking off in 2014 for different reasons. So that's how I got into, yes, there's something here more than marketing and there's real technology here and we should be able to build something that can actually answer questions on par with network domain experts.
So when you say answer questions on par with network domain experts, what kind of questions? Like, what are you thinking of?
So when we started, we thought of, hey, why are you having a bad user experience, right? And this is what I call the paradigm shift from 20 years ago, I started a company called Airspace. That's back when we did all these wireless controllers and everything. I would say that was the paradigm of, hey, I'm here to help you manage the network box. I'm here to build some software and help you manage all these network boxes you have. The paradigm is really shifting now to, hey, I'm really here to help you manage some end-to-end user experience. And this really came to light when I was at Cisco because I was talking to some very big retail customers. And they had, three things. I was trying to sell this whole connected mobile experience thing to them. And they were like, hey, Bob, we're not going to deploy any of those controllers until they stop crashing. So basically they're asking for more reliable software, right? They're also like, hey, I'm starting to deploy these mobile apps, right? Consumer apps. And knowing that the APs up wasn't good enough anymore, they really want to know what was the user experience like? Was the user having a problem? And then the third thing is they wanted speed. They wanted me to be able to keep up, telling them that, I would give them a release that, every 6 months or a year, fix a problem wasn't good enough. And when you look at it, that's what the cloud fixed, right? Developing software in the cloud just solves a whole bunch. It's just a better architecture and way of developing software. So it gets things where we release code every week reliably. Right. So that kind of solves the software reliability problem. The AI piece kind of solves that day two operations problem of now I really want to be able to answer questions of like, why are you having a bad internet experience? And that's why we started with the access point, right? Because when you start to answer that question, the access layer there has a lot of information necessary to answer that question. And so that was the starting point for, hey, I want to answer this question. What data do I need to answer this question?
So when you answer that question, how are you answering it? I mean, I'm just like, what are you specifically asking? I mean, I'm a little bit.
Well, I'll give you an example. Like, when we started, and I would say, when we started this journey, everyone's very skeptical of AI. How long, can it really do these types of things? But, specific examples, like when you're in a big warehouse with robots and barcode readers, right? And you're having a problem of some sort of connection problem. there's something called mutual information. And mutual information is something that lets you basically take user experience data. And that was probably the other big change at Mist, was really we started aggregating down for each user, right? Not each access point, each user. We basically started keeping track of the state of that user. So when the state changes and we see the state, we can actually see the user go into a bad state. Now the question is, how do we figure out what network feature calls that bad state? And so that's where mutual information helps you answer that question, where you have two variables, right? You have one is user experience, bad or good, and you have 50 network features. So that's a specific example where these AI ML algorithms actually make a difference. Now, I would tell you, AI is doing something on par with human. MLs are algorithms that actually solve particular problems like mutual information. That's not AI. You need to basically gather up a whole bunch of different algorithms to answer questions on par with experts, right? It's not just one algorithm. So mutual information is this one algorithm that helps us figure out, you know, why is that robot having a problem in the distribution center? You know, why is that barcode reader having a problem?
That makes me think of a question. So if you started on the AP, and obviously you're going to be missing, there's going to be gaps. There's going to be a data that you will not be able to get off of just the AP. So how did that play out? How did you fill those gaps when all you had to look at was the AP? And currently, I'm assuming that progress has been made and it's not just the AP anymore, right?
Correct. I mean, so it started with the access point. I would say the next piece of the puzzle was LLDP. It's this very secret protocol that no one knows about. It turns out that gives you a lot of visibility into the switch, right? So from there, we got visibility back into all the switches, you know, Cisco, HP, Mist. It doesn't make any difference because that's a standard. Then we actually have started to put SDKs on the devices, which brings the client view into Marvis, right? You know, so if we start seeing asymmetry between the AP and the client, that can help us start to figure out whether it's a real client problem. And then the latest thing we're starting to do is bring in the switch and the SD-WAN router. Now, when you look at the SD-WAN router, as you bring more things into this AI ops layer, this allows us to answer more questions with more granularity, right? As you start to bring something like the SD-WAN router into Marvis or AI, it lets us start to answer different questions, right? Because this starts to bring in kind of the session level, application level data. You know, so then we can start answering questions like, why is the user having a Zoom problem or a Teams problem? And you kind of see how this is going to expand. This is why AI is kind of an overarching layer on top of your network, right? Depending on what question you want to answer, you may have to extract data from different sources. So I mean, you can envision the day where we'd be pulling data from the weather report, right? You know, trying to predict whether or not your data center is going to overheat, right? Hey guys, it's going to be 110 degrees. Beware of power outage.
So what about, so this all sounds very reactive, which is great. I mean, there's a ton of value there as a network operator, I can say. What are the thoughts about making it proactive? What if you're looking at something that's not built? You don't have any tables to interrogate or any links to look at or anything like that.
Well, I mean, I think the days of magically, trying to predict a problem, like the temperature thing, I mean, you can start to be able to predict things when you start to see fans go bad, right? I mean, so it turns out that the latest thing we're looking at is fans and switches and routers. It turns out that you can start to predict that if you see one go bad, that, hey, you know, it's likely that thing is going to overheat and be a problem. There's things like memory leaks, right? If you start to see memory leaks in your data center, that type of stuff is predictive, right? You don't have to wait till the thing crashes. You can see the memory leak start to crawl up. There's things like anomaly detection where you can start to predict, time to connect failures. You start to see your time to connect that you can get a little bit ahead of the game. It's almost like earthquake though. The question is, how much prediction time can we give you? Is it seconds, minutes, hours, days?
Right.
So are you looking at routing protocols and control plane stuff as well right now? Or are you only looking at more data plane transport type stuff?
Well, like I said, right now, when we started this, it was really around connectivity experiences. Why is a user or device having a bad connectivity experience? I would say, what we're starting to look at is starting to expand that across, the AP, the switch, and the router. The router lets us start to answer questions like, why is the application having a problem? When you get into the data center, I think where we're seeing AI go, in the AP world, it's all about user connectivity and user experience. When you get into the data center, it's really more about application experience. People want to know, why can't application A talk to application B, right? We're routing packets across a very complicated mesh, leaf, spline network. and this thing is dropping packets. So I would say that's probably the next thing is when you get in the data center, it's the same theory, just a slightly different. We're not talking about people anymore. We're actually talking about applications trying to talk to each other and communicate with each other.
This brings up a good, I think, semantic discussion. So in the context, and I know there are academic definitions for these things, but in the context of network operations, what is the difference between AI and ML for this problem space?
Like I say, for me in particular, AI implies that you're doing something on par with the human, right? I mean, we're trying to build something to drive a car on par with the human. We're trying to build something that can do image recognition. You know, I can diagnose X-rays on par with the radiologist type of thing. In our case, the AI piece of, we're trying to answer questions on par with network domain experts, right? You know, that are complicated problems. ML is basically an algorithm, right? ML to me is, okay, yes, I can take a machine learning algorithm and basically make a location estimate, but I'm not doing anything on par with a human yet. Yes, I'm using ML to do something. And my example, right, you know, in the warehouse, right? Yes, I'm using mutual information, which is an ML thing, to basically tell you what network feature is most likely causing this user experience problem. But I haven't answered a question on par with a network domain expert yet, right? It's one algorithm. And I think you'll find that in almost all the AI stuff cars, right, it's not one algorithm usually doing it. There's several algorithms working together to try to get something to do something on par with a human.
So you would say that something that does deep learning that has more than one stage, let's say, of ML combined together in a network of MLs would be closer to an AI in...
Semantically, deep learning, is this another ML algorithm? I mean, when you say deep learning, you're usually talking convolutional neural networks that are kind of the basis of all the image recognition, right? When you look at all the speech and time series stuff, that's LSTM. That's a form, and that was part of the 2014 transformation, is that these neural networks finally got big enough with enough data to start doing interesting things around 2014. That there was kind of this magical point where, you know, we had enough training data and enough compute to build neural networks that did interesting things. You know, my funny story is 20 years ago, my master's, I did my master's on neural networks. So it's not like this stuff hasn't been around for a while. It's just we didn't have enough compute power and data to actually do anything interesting for a long time.
Well, it seems to me, if you're looking for a corpus to draw from, a body of knowledge, a network's a great place to get it. You have all kinds of stuff, right? You have forwarding tables, you have all the metrics from the devices themselves, and you could get any depth that you wanted. But it seems to me the difference here is context, right? And ML, in the way you've been talking about it, kind of what I'm getting, tell me if I'm getting this right. ML will solve a specific problem. We'll look for a certain sort of outcome. But without context, it's not really intelligent. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I would say, you know, when you actually get down to trying to build this stuff, you'll find that the convolutional neural network or the LSTM algorithm is the simplest part of the problem. I mean, any kid out of college, I mean, right now, you could basically, by over the weekend, learn how to train a neural network model if you haven't done it yet, right? The bigger problem is what I call feature engineering of, you know, now I've got to take a PhD guy who understands all the math, but he doesn't understand the domain, right? The question is, what network features do you need to actually put into the model and train the model with? You know, and so that's probably the hardest part in getting this, all this stuff to work is you got to take the data science person and the domain expert and somehow get them to work together to actually solve a problem. And you'll find you spend most of your time do what they call data engineering, right? You know, I've got to build a pipe. I got to get this data from some source into some format that the algorithm can work on. You may spend months getting that done. The actual model is probably a couple of weeks of effort to get the model figured out.
So you mentioned feature a couple of times. When I hear feature, I think I hear something different than what you're saying. Can you expand on that? When you say the feature is what's missing, what is that? What do you mean by that?
Like the warehouse problem, you know, hey, I've got all these barcodes or these other things that are having a hard time connecting. You know, so a network feature could be DHCP, DNS, internet, driver type, OS type. I mean, there's all types of features, configuration, right? And you're basically trying to figure out, you know, why is this device having a problem? you know, and you've probably done this yourself, right? You know, you're trying to figure out why the device is having a problem. And it turns out that, you know, someone's misconfigured the router on the other side of the network. You know, it's like, it could take you hours to figure out that, okay, I finally figured out that this thing is misconfigured, that someone's changed MTU size on it. And that's why I can't authenticate anymore, right? Because I can't afford large packets.
So your version of feature is much wider than what we would consider a feature, Tom.
Right.
Yeah. And those are network features, right? I mean, these are all the network features that could somehow be related to this problem.
Right. So by feature, you mean a protocol, you mean a configuration, you mean just about anything in the network that's out there. Right. Whereas in our world, a feature is more of just a something you've added to the protocol, the ability to do X or to the box or something like that. So you're primarily based on or using open standard protocols for most of this, or are you using agent based, or how are you getting into the boxes to do the AI functions? I mean, I'm curious about this because, of course, anybody who hears this kind of thing is going to say, yeah, well, that's great, but collecting data is probably the hardest part of this from a network perspective, because I've got all these devices out here in my brownfield.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why we built our own access point, because I wanted to make, I wasn't going to trust Cisco and Aruba to give me the data I needed to answer the question. Right. You know, so I guess that access point becomes a sensor, right, to some extent into the picture. There are standards, like when you get to APIs, there's things like I said, LLDP. I mean, LLDP is a good source of data that's standardized across the industry. OpenConfig, I don't know if you guys have heard of OpenConfig.
Yep.
So that's more for configuration, but they're also looking at using that to get more data, more standardized data out of the thing. As I mentioned, I'm working at OGNOG right now. You know, questions, you know, if you want to answer a question that requires you to get data from two or three different cloud vendors, can we virtualize the data in place? You know, start with the question, figure out what data you need from the different vendors, and securely virtualize the data in Access so we don't have to build big data lakes. Which seemed to be a big waste of time. You talk to people, spend months, years building these data lakes and probably only use 5% of the data that they store away in them.
So that's actually an interesting problem, because we often think about telemetry being an issue with a brownfield with lots of different vendors or being cross-vendor. But we don't think about it being a problem when we think about cross-cloud vendor. And yet we've just transferred the problem from Cisco, Juniper, Arista to Amazon, Google.
But if you think about it, right, the whole industry is moving to cloud SaaS. I mean, so to some extent, we have each of us have the customer's data somewhere in the cloud somewhere, right? Whether it's Google, Amazon, or Microsoft, we're storing the data in the cloud on behalf of the customer. You know, the question is, you know, does it really make sense to pull all that data out and, okay, let's go pull all the data and stick it in another cloud?
Well, I guess this comes down to a timing issue as well, right? How long do you need the data, and how much of the data do you need for that long period of time? And how much data do you need to do trend analysis and understand what the trends are in a particular area or region, right? Or a particular place, or like you say, a feature, and how that feature is working.
And that's why you need to start with the question. What question are you trying to answer, right? Because that will drive what data you need.
Right.
So all of this, as I'm listening to this, is really interesting. All of it, though, seems to me to be sort of an event correlation engine. Like I'm failing to see any big magic. And when I hear, and especially with what you were saying at the beginning, when you were saying we want this to be on par with the intuition of a human, right? Somebody who can take context, and there's a lot of things that a human brain can do that a machine just can't do. I wonder, have you ever considered thinking a little bigger, thinking about how to get that context data from an expert directly into the system rather than through this proxy that is forwarding tables and configuration and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, I think that's the feedback mechanism. Marvis, right? I mean, right now, you know, we basically use Marvis to answer every support ticket that comes into MIST. Now, the feedback mechanism from the domain expert is basically, okay, Marvis, you got the wrong answer, right? And so that's basically, yeah. So the domain expert, none of this, yeah, you know, like you say, none of this is magic. It's all a bunch of complicated math, and it's a feedback, right? You spend most of your time with the domain expert training the algorithm, you know, and it's a lot about getting labeled data. The question is, how do I get the data and the domain expertise to train this model. So that's kind of the difference in the next, I think the next generation of tools, that these tools nowadays, you buy a management tool, you set it up and you use it. It doesn't really get any better after the first day you buy it, right? It may release a few new features to you.
Right.
You know, this is more of the concept is the more you work with it, the more it learns.
Interesting. And what's the, and maybe you haven't crossed this threshold yet, but at what point does data become too old to be useful and not worth storing?
It depends. I mean, if you're looking for seasonality, right? If you're looking for the difference between spring and winter, right? That's a year.
Right.
I would tell you, for anomaly detection, we usually go back 3 months. You know, like if I'm trying to predict every hour what the connection rate or the connection failures or time should be, we usually go back 3 months. You know, and that takes care of all the weekly anomalies, right? That takes care of a bunch of anomalies that would happen on Saturday and Sunday and all that type of stuff. And I think that addresses the rest of your kind of questions on site. Yes, every site is different. No two networks are created equal. So you have to, you know, it depends what you're trying to do, but you typically have to train down to the site level.
Right. Yeah, because that's a pushback I've heard from like Dave Meyer and several other people, that AI really isn't useful for networks because you have to train it on a per network basis. And every network is a snowflake. So I think there are two pushbacks to that. The first is what you just said, is that you actually do train to the site, right? I mean, that's what you have to do to make it useful in many cases.
Yeah. I mean, you have a site in India and a site in, you know, one site's running on a DSL and the other one's running on a 1 gig Comcast. Like, yeah, they're going to have different, you know, they're going to behave differently.
What about the, so you mentioned Jeopardy at the beginning, you know, humans playing against computers. Have any experiments been done in a similar sort of thing here? You know, here's Marvis, it's trained up, it's good to go. And here's a human operator familiar with the network. Any competition results from that?
No, we did a customer advisory board every year. And yes, we did. We had the Marvis versus domain experts. And I would say, you know, we're not quite the championship level yet. You know, if you watch Mobility Field Day, I think we're, what we would claim is Marvis can now answer about 60 to 70% of support tickets. You know, Marvis either has the answer or Marvis can, you know, get you closer to the data faster, help solve the problem. Now, championship level is like 90%. It's like, hey, guys,
yeah,
now.
Right.
But I would tell you, I've been at it for 4 years. We're getting closer and closer to championship level Jeopardy here.
Nice.
So I guess the other way you could push back against that, every network is a snowflake and they all have to be trained separately, is they shouldn't be, right? Application-wise, they might be, but there should be a lot of commonality, right, between different types of networks, particularly in the data center, even in the wireless range. You should have a lot of commonality. I mean, there's only so many building plans. There's only so many topologies and so many control planes and so many applications. Well, not applications, because we seem to have a million coders coding new applications every day. So maybe that's not true.
Well,
yeah, there are some models. I mean, it depends what you're trying to do, but there are some models that are global. It's like, guys, I don't care where you are in the world. 802.11 is a standard and it doesn't change where you're in the world. So if we're trying to model that, that's probably a global model. But like connection times, right? That's site dependent on, yes, you know, depends what the network, you know, depends on the network and the LANs and the WAN speeds on what your success connect is going to be. That's a very complicated question because of all the timeouts. You start to see problem, right? You get a slow enough link, then yes, things start to fail. .1x starts to fail sometimes.
What about, have you seen in the time this has been running and running on real networks, have any patterns emerged that that seem to be sort of aha, like, oh, this is a different way to rather than troubleshoot, but this is a different way to build, like to design and architect these things. Anything like that that's interesting?
I think what we're starting to see is, I mean, I'm starting to see a little bit more machine to machine stuff happen, you know, where you start to see the beginnings of remediation, right? You know, if Marvis sees bad hardware or bad software, they're starting to basically, okay, I trust you to generate the ticket to ServiceNow. I will pull the human out of the, you know, we won't have a human verify. It's kind of the, hey, I trust you, Marvis, to make the right answer now. Don't ask me again type of thing. So I think we're starting to see the very beginnings of more machine to machine, right? Where people start trusting this stuff. And they're starting to free up the IT resources to do something else besides double checking the bad cable problem.
Right, right. And that's cool. In operations, that's actually really valuable, I think. But I guess more what I'm wondering about, I didn't say my question very well, is in my experience, once you see something start to repeat itself in a few different mutations, you start to your own thought process starts to think, oh, I might have missed something when I originally built this, when I originally modeled or designed this thing. I'm wondering if you've gotten any insights into people are consistently doing this wrong, or the protocol has a weakness that we just observed because of, you know, OSPF is doing something wacky because Marvis told us we keep having these things happen on OSPF networks. Anything like that?
I would say the closest thing I've seen is missing VLANs. You know, once people figure out why they're missing VLANs and creating black holes, you know, they find why that hole got there. I've seen probably cases where people swear that the DHCP server cannot be connected. There's no way that, you know, they could get to that DHCP server, and they find out they have a hole in their network that they didn't expect to have. So I'm seeing that type of behavior. I think the biggest thing I've seen change, you know, over my 20 years has been the API, right? The people are starting to become much more, you know, IT is becoming another programming field, right? If you want to be an IT person, you better learn Python or programming, because the world's becoming a world of APIs, automation, troubleshooting. It's all, you know, that seems to be happening very fast now.
Right. Agreed.
So one thing I want to ask you about that you said earlier is that the world is moving to cloud. Do you think there'll be any pushback against that at any point? Because I think I'm starting to see some pushback against all cloud all the time. People are starting to be a little more realistic about where they put their workloads, and they're not all going to cloud. They're actually going more hybrid and figuring out where to put things.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's not so much cloud as it is software architectures. You know, 20 years ago when I did aerospace, right, I was doing these embedded software architectures where we had these very long regression test cycles. The thing that's really changing is this microservices, hey, we're going to continuous integration tests, right? We're releasing code every week or every 2 weeks reliably. Now, where that code runs, whether it runs at Amazon or Google or it runs right at the on-ramp of the internet, you know, you're seeing things like StackPath, right? We're seeing a whole bunch of people, okay, let's move compute storage right to the POP.
Edge compute, let's
move the compute storage to on-prem. But the big thing that's changing is really even the compute storage moves on-prem, what's changing is the software architecture of how you develop and maintain code. That's probably the big architectural change, independent of where the compute storage wants to run.
Right.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So move on to ONUG a little bit. You said a little bit earlier about ONUG and work on Data Lake. So explain a little bit about what you're doing there. And I don't know how many people even know what the ONUG is. So maybe it might be worth just saying a word or two about who the ONUG is.
Yeah. ONUG is Open Network User Group. It's really kind of a group of industry, both customers and vendors, who tend to try to work on problems that are common across the industry. And the problem we're working on right there right now is in what we call the AI Ops Working Group. And this is really looking at the, you know, if we look at AI Ops, you know, back to, hey, I want to answer a question or do something on part of the human, I may have to get data from multiple sources. Now, the other trend is, you know, as people move to more cloud models, it tends that most of this data is already stored in some sort of bulk storage, right? S3 or somewhere, Google, you know, we're storing data more and more into bulk storage. So the concept was, hey, instead of trying to put all this data into some big data lake, and, you know, if you talk to these enterprise, they could spend a year, right? If they're building a data lake, they could, before they even get to answering a question, they could probably spend a year or more trying to get the data lake up and running and built and everything. So that's the concept of ONUG right now is, hey, as we move to cloud, you know, let's leave the data in place, leave the data at rest. Let's see if we can virtualize that data and only pull the data out that we need to answer whatever question, business question we're trying to answer. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, sure. So treat the existing data stores as big backend databases that you can query whenever you want to.
Right. You know, the question is how to virtualize those things securely. You know, how do you create kind of a virtual SQL interface so you can pull the data out that you need?
Now, this seems to kind of run counter to the generalized conception if people have of big data or data analytics, which is that you throw data at some ML and just let it look for patterns. And so you're not really asking questions. You're just throwing data at it and saying, tell me what you see. Now, is that true? I mean, is that like a misconception or is that, I don't know.
I would say that is a misconception of the, you know, I don't think there's any magical ML out there that you just throw data at and it magically gives you insights. Right. In my experience, you know, ML is a tool. You know, as I said, most of the work is on feature engineering of what features. You need some domain expert who knows something about the features. You know, you just don't randomly put features into an ML. I go, question, where would you start? You know, if I've got this ML model over here, you know, what features would you stick in it? You know, when you actually look at a model, right, think of it as a box, right? There's a vector that goes in and there's a vector that comes out. You know, that's how the deep learning stuff works. You know, so you got to decide what's that input vector look like, what's in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And you got to decide what questions you want to ask out of that data. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not, I don't think there's a magical, let's just dump all the data into this magical neural network and then out pops an answer. Someone's got to sit down there and engineer it, you know, think about it a little bit.
Okay, cool. Any more questions, Tom?
No, it's been great.
Okay, good. All right. I guess we'll wrap up there. So Tom, where can people get in touch with you if they want to? I know you're still not blogging, so I'm not even going to bother asking.
Ugh, the shame, the shame will never be erased. I'm at LinkedIn. Search for me, Tom Ammon. There's not too many Tom Ammons. And then Twitter as well.
All right. Just look for the Tom Ammon with the world in his background. And Bob, I assume with all the research you're working on, there must be some blog or some place where people can follow some of the work you're doing, or they can go to ONUG and look at the working groups that you're in and stuff like that.
Yeah, they go on LinkedIn and bob@mist.com. So if they want to reach out, I'm happy to chat.
Okay.
You know, AI is a topic dear to my heart. So
okay.
Always happy to chat about AI.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, Bob, for joining us for this episode of The Hedge. And we'll catch you next time.
Subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.